So it's my pleasure to introduce today Kent Willis, who is our next speaker. He's Executive Director for the Virginia Chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union, and you've been Executive Director since 1989, is that right?
Yes.
Kent has done a lot of work with a lot of different nonprofit groups and has given a lot back to the community. His wife is Dr. Sheila Crowley. She's President of the National Low Income Housing Coalition in Washington, D.C., and Kent and his wife live in Fredericksburg, Virginia, which is a case that we're heavily contested, his group and ours, at this particular point in time. Kent is the principal spokesman for the ACLU of Virginia. He's done a lot of press and media, NBC, all the major networks. So it's a pleasure having you here, Kent.
Hey, thanks, John. Good morning, everyone. I'm going to sit if it's okay. And I'll just start talking. I'm going to tell you a little about the ACLU. I am going to put a lot of it in the context of how a public interest organization like the ACLU works, and particularly how we work with volunteers and what we call cooperating attorneys, which are attorneys who do give their time pro bono to the work that we do and ultimately probably form the backbone of the organization. So I do want to talk a little about that, and then I'll get into some of the issues, particularly here in Virginia, although I'm happy to talk about national issues as well. Feel free to interrupt beginning now. I sort of know the points I want to make. I'll figure out how to make them, whether it's in the exact order I conceived them to be. We'll see as we get along.
They've all read your sampler. So.
What's that?
They've all read the ACLU sampler.
Okay, terrific. Okay. So, like I said, feel free if to go ahead and ask questions about anything that I'm talking about. The truth is my preference is to sort of have a dialogue in a gathering like this as opposed to just lecturing to you. But before going into the ACLU, how we're organized, how we operate, and the kind of work we're doing a little bit nationally and here, I think I want to go straight to a case, and we'll come back to some of the sort of structural organizational stuff. And the reason is there is a case that John referenced going on right now, and it's a case out of Fredericksburg, Virginia. And it's one that's interesting because the Rutherford Institute and the ACLU are on different sides in the same case. And it's interesting, too, because a couple of the issues that that float through this case are some of the more important issues right now if you're thinking about issues like free exercise, freedom of speech, and separation of church and state. And it's some of the sort of defining issues. And I know that all of you know about these issues, including the class from UVA, right? So I know that the students from the Rutherford Institute have probably, well, I'm sure you're all very familiar with it. So let me just talk about a little about that case, though. I live in Fredericksburg, Virginia. I moved there about 7 years ago. I lived in Richmond, where the ACLU was located since the early 1970s. I moved to Fredericksburg because my wife got this wonderful job in D.C. As the head of the National Low Income Housing Coalition. She had worked with homeless people for most of her career prior to that, and this was sort of a natural transition. Moving to Fredericksburg meant putting us between the two places so that she gets to commute about 55 miles to D.C. and I get to commute about 60 miles to Richmond each day. My thought in making this move was that I had finally taken a step that was going to cause me to sour on one of my jobs. I have held public interest jobs since I graduated from college in 1971. I will tell you that in my personal opinion, if you enter into the public interest world and you are doing something that you care about, then you will be lucky enough to every single day when you leave work feel good about it, whether you've won or lost whatever the issue was that day. I know of no more people who are more satisfied with their work than people who do public interest work, and whether it's for a conservative organization or a liberal organization or somewhere in between, it can be enormously personally satisfying, and it also fulfills that sense that we've had, I think, sort of ever since the Greeks that there is an obligation for all of us to contribute to society in some way beyond our own selves. So a few years ago, I got a letter from a Fredericksburg resident, and the letter said that she had gone to a city council meeting 6 months or so before, and at the meeting, one of the members of city council, in opening the city council meeting with a prayer, gave a Christian prayer. She said she was Jewish, and that she found that sort of, you know, unsettling and demeaning, because here were the official opening prayers of city council meeting delivered as a Christian prayer, and she felt that the message coming from city council was that if you weren't Christian, you practiced a secondary or less important religion, and she was offended by that. So she wrote the councilman, Reverend Hashmel Turner, and she asked Reverend Turner, she explained to Turner her feelings and asked him not to do it anymore. And Reverend Turner was newly elected at that time to city council. City council in Fredericksburg, like many city councils and many other governing bodies, open their meetings with a prayer. And as probably every one of you knows in this room, the basic rules about those prayers, at least as we can discern from Marsh v. Chambers, the Supreme Court decision from 83, I believe, and later the Allegheny decision, is that because of tradition, essentially, you can open a government meeting with a prayer without violating the Establishment Clause, but that prayer has to be non-sectarian. It cannot be a prayer that alludes specifically to a particular religion. That's the sort of rules that have generally come down, a little oversimplified, from the Supreme Court, and it's what most places follow, most local jurisdictions follow. Anyway, city council in Fredericksburg rotates among the city council members, as a lot of places do. One person does it one meeting, 2 weeks later the next meeting, another person does it, and they are given somewhat free rein to give the prayer their choice. The assumption being, though, that the prayer will be non-sectarian. Fredericksburg has been doing that for many years, has had ministers on its council before. In all instances leading up to Reverend Hashmel Turner, the prayer delivered was a non-sectarian prayer. Some were hardly prayers at all. Some were simply ways of solemnizing the occasion without necessarily even referencing a supreme being. Others were prayers in which a supreme being is generally acknowledged, but no specific religion. So Hashmel Turner departed from the tradition in Fredericksburg. There was no exact policy or rules for him to follow. It wasn't that he was violating a particular rule set down by council at the time. It was simply his choice, and no one seemed to care too much about it, apparently, except for this one woman who complained. She wrote me to say that she had written him. She'd asked him to stop doing it. He'd written back a letter saying he understood her complaint and that he indeed would stop doing it. And I can't remember if this took place in a conversation or with in writing. But she had gone back to a meeting some months later, and he decided to do it again, so she decided to write the ACLU. What she didn't realize was that in writing me in Richmond, Virginia, she was writing another constituent of Hashmel Turner. I actually live in his district in Fredericksburg, and so I wrote him a letter. Typical for us, believe it or not, because it doesn't usually get into the media, the first step in any controversy like this is for us to write a letter and to typically not publicize that letter. In other words, you try to, anything like this, if you can resolve the matter sort of quietly and rationally, that's the best way to do it. So I wrote a letter to him, both as director of the ACLU of Virginia, but also as a constituent, and made two arguments, and one was the legal argument that I just made to you, and the other was that as a constituent, I felt that he served the broad community best by having prayers that were not divisive, but prayers that were more all-embracing and ecumenical, because those kinds of prayers do what opening prayers are supposed to do, and that is they bring people together, solemnize the occasion, acknowledge that we're all here for a particular purpose, and sort of governing, in this case, the city. And that I hope that kind of that statesmanship would trump his desire to give a sectarian prayer in this case. And as it happened, he ended up not doing it again for a while, but then started up again. And also, our next letter went to city council. And that letter said, you need to tell this guy that he can't do these kinds of sectarian prayers because they violate the Supreme Court rules on this, violate the Establishment Clause. City Council sort of had a choice, really. What was going to happen ultimately is either they were going to let him continue with these prayers, which would have brought a lawsuit eventually against the city for allowing the prayers, and that would have been a lawsuit from the ACLU or Americans United for Separation of Church and State or People for the American Way. There were a number of organizations sort of hovering outside this scenario, as you typically see in this kind of situation. The other side would be for city council to pass a policy or tell Hashmel Turner that he cannot deliver these kinds of sectarian prayers. They chose the latter course, and created a policy, and then decided not to let him pray until he indicated he would follow the policy. And of course, that brought a lawsuit from the Rutherford Institute on behalf of Hashmel Turner. And that case is in court right now in federal district court. There have not been, as the Rutherford Institute people know, I'm sure, there haven't been any kind of hearings on it. And we will move from here. Of course, I've described this case entirely from an Establishment Clause perspective, but the truth is there are compelling arguments that go in a lot of different directions with this case that give the organizations like the ACLU a little trouble as well. The last thing the ACLU wants to do as an organization that promotes free speech is interfere with the right of someone to exercise their religion or their right to free speech. And, of course, that's the argument that Turner is making. In this case, we have the Supreme Court decisions pretty much on our side. Now, those are Supreme Court decisions from the past, and as everyone knows, all these things are subject to change, and they're especially subject to tweaking. And the Supreme Court gave us something a little odd when they gave us the Marsh v. Chambers decision. I mean, I heard a lawyer arguing the Marsh case, arguing using the Marsh case, describing it as an Establishment Clause, an island in a sea of Establishment Clause cases. And what he meant by that was that if you look at the thread that runs through the Establishment Clause cases since the early 1960s, and I guess you could probably go back to the 40s even if you wanted, you find the U.S. Supreme Court being fairly consistent, moving a little forward sometime, moving a little backward sometime, moving out on the edges as particular facts come to them, but a lot of consistency in the strain of thought regarding interpretation of the Establishment Clause. The one that really does sort of stick out is Marsh v. Chambers, because applying consistently the Establishment Clause arguments to that case, it's hard to imagine allowing a governmental entity to open a meeting with a prayer. I mean, it is government prayer. Most of the Establishment Clause decisions Lemon v. Kurtzman and all the rest say that the government can't promote a religion, government can't inhibit religion, government can't get itself entangled with religion, and the purpose of any governmental action can't be to promote. So it's either promote and effects. You know the case, I'm sure. Marsh v. Chambers does not fit squarely with that. On the other hand, it runs up against a huge tradition in the United States. I mean, a long history of solemnizing meetings with prayers. And the court really just, I think, didn't know what to do with it. My feeling is this. It approached the case this way. One, it's inconsistent with the rest of our Establishment Clause decisions. Two, we can't not allow government meetings to be opened with a prayer. So how do we do it? And so they come up with this sort of rule that they end up with in Marsh v. Chambers. And so, you know, that's sort of what we're stuck with. And I'm not sure that the ACLU, for example, particularly likes Marsh v. Chambers. We work within that because that's the rule that's given to us. So what we have here is a man on city council who says, listen, I should have the right to, I'm being given the right to say a prayer. Why can't it be a prayer of any kind that I want? And we're dealing with this technicality of sectarian versus non-sectarian prayers. I think the whole issue of sectarian versus non-sectarian prayers, official prayers by governing entities, is probably one we're going to be dealing with for some time. And the reason we are is not because of a technical difference between sectarian and non-sectarian. It's the free speech argument that comes into play. Once the free speech argument comes into play, then we find ourselves, I think, not moving beyond the sort of sectarian, non-sectarian, that is, can you designate the nature of a prayer that someone says? But we begin to look differently at the whole notion, I think, of prayer and government. And we can be headed into some very interesting times with the changes in the U.S. Supreme Court. But anyway, that's the Turner case. The reason I bring it up is the Rutherford Institute and the ACLU on different sides in that case. As we define our different organizations, in a way we're very similar organizations because we are different from most other nonprofit advocacy groups. Most nonprofit advocacy groups are single issue groups. They pick an issue, they advocate for that issue, and they don't care how it bumps up against other constitutional issues, civil liberties and civil rights. An organization like the Rutherford Institute and the ACLU, because we are multi-purpose organizations that deal with a broad array of rights, often find ourselves within our own organizations. Now, I don't know that the Rutherford Institute has this dilemma. The ACLU does, where we bump up against principles within the Constitution or within the Bill of Rights, and we have to decide which side we're on, and it's not always easy. And I'm going to give an example of that that came out of Virginia, too, one right out of UVA, Rosenberger v. UVA. And, of course, that's the case that went to the U.S. Supreme Court involving the funding of a student religious magazine. And the two arguments on that side, one was Establishment Clause argument that state or government money should not go directly to fund a religious purpose. That seems to be pretty consistent with the U.S. Supreme Court rulings on the Establishment Clause. The other side of it is that why doesn't this student magazine have the same right to funding as any other student magazine? If a student magazine promoting communism or the Democratic Party or the Republican Party or any particular philosophical, ideological underpinnings, why can't, isn't it discriminatory, isn't it viewpoint discrimination not to allow this magazine to receive the same funds as any other magazine? The reason I bring up this is that the ACLU nationally and in Virginia had to make a decision about where we came down on this case. This was not a case brought by us, but we filed an amicus brief in it. And at the Supreme Court level, amicus briefs can be very important. They can be important symbolically. They also can be important in terms of articulating very specific kinds of arguments that maybe neither side otherwise articulates. And so the ACLU has a long history of amicus briefs in the U.S. Supreme Court. A typical case coming to the ACLU would be, do we get involved in this case or not? We know where we stand on the case. The question is it a priority? How does it rank up against the other cases that are out there, the other places that are asking for our assistance? So this one, though, was different. It goes to the National ACLU. There's a board of directors of about 80 people. They're present, and what they're voting on is which side of this case we should be on. Everybody knows we're coming in on the case, but the question is, which side is the ACLU on? The ultimate vote, and the question is, are we on the establishment, the sort of strict establishment clause side on the funding issue, or are we on the free speech or viewpoint discrimination side? And you can't be on both in a case like this. You have to take one side or the other. The vote was, if my memory is correct, 40 to 38 of the 78 people. There were 78 people present. 40 people said this is an establishment clause case, and that's where the ACLU should write its amicus brief. And 38 people said, nope, this is a free speech, free exercise case, and that's where the ACLU ought to write its amicus brief. The reason I bring this up, of course, is it does show to you how, you know, if we were a fair housing organization, it wouldn't matter. If we Americans United for Separation of Church and State, right? They're not thinking about the free speech part of this case. They come right into it with their sort of single issue, line up where they line up. But it's not always that simple for the ACLU. And so, for example, right now, while the Rutherford Institute and the ACLU are on opposite sides of the case that I just described to you, the Rutherford Institute and the ACLU are doing two cases together in court. One of them is the Collins case. And I think that, which ones of you are the students of the Rutherford Institute folks? Okay, so you're all, okay, right here. The UVA students weren't here last week, but Rich Collins was, right? And Steve Rosenfield, who are, Collins, of course, is the plaintiff in the case. Plaintiff in the civil case, defendant in the criminal case. But do your students know about the Collins case?
No, our class has only been meeting for about 4 days.
Okay, all right. Then I'll give a brief description of it. But since I know you guys focused on that last time, you probably don't even want to talk about that anymore. I do understand you got a good strong blast of Rich Collins' personality, though. Rich Collins is a retired UVA professor. Is that right? He was at Shopper's World. Out on Route 29, the last year, year before, the year the case is from, I can't remember. But anyway, what he was doing was he was running in the primary for the House of Delegates, and he was being a politician. He was out there handing out his literature and talking to folks at the shopping center. Shopper's World, like most suburban located shopping center shopping malls, is private property. It is not. He has a right under the First Amendment of the Constitution to stand in a public park, to stand on a sidewalk, to stand in any public place and distribute literature. There's no question about that, and were he prevented from doing that, particularly as someone with a political message, then clearly whoever, a police officer or whatever, had interfered with that right would be in the wrong, and there'd be no question about it. But he was standing on what looks to me and you like a public forum. It's a shopping center in a shopping mall. You know, people drive in or in a shopping center, park their cars and walk along the sidewalk just like they do in the downtown mall or anywhere else that you might consider a traditional public forum. So he was standing there doing that. He was ultimately arrested for trespassing. And the interesting thing is typically what we find with these situations is a tradition of high tolerance on the part of store owners and the like to this sort of activity. Most shopping centers acknowledge that that people come and go, not in their stores. Obviously, they have total control once you're inside the store. But in terms of the parking lot and the sidewalks outside stores, they typically are treated like public forum. But Collins was arrested for trespassing, and he came to us. And we came to the Rutherford Institute, and we all ended up defending his right to do this. It's a tough case, because technically there's no difference between that sidewalk in front of a store and your lawn in front of your house, or maybe your sidewalk. You know, there's an assumption, for example, if someone comes into your yard, if someone comes into your house, up your sidewalk and knocks on your door, unless you have a no trespassing sign, the assumption is that they have a right to do that. You can then say leave. If they don't leave, they're trespassing, and then you can go from there. And so most store owners treat this property the same as that, something between a traditional public forum and the way that someone might get to your house to distribute literature or something like that. So in this instance, though, of course, they told him to leave. He didn't, and he was literally arrested for trespassing. Our argument, a very difficult one, is that that in suburban locations in particular, because of the loss of traditional, because there are no traditional public forums, in most suburban locations there is simply no downtown. There is no there are no public parks that are situated the way they are in traditional town centers, where the public park actually gives you access to a large number of human beings. What has replaced the town center, the traditional town center, which gives us the traditional public forum, is the sidewalks and parking lots in shopping centers and shopping malls. Now, technically, they can argue, well, he can stand on the nearest public forum and still accomplish his goal. But our argument is there is no such thing. In most shopping centers, you have the shopping center, private property. You have the sidewalk, private property. You have the parking lot, private property. And there's typically not even a sidewalk, you know, between that parking lot and, say, Route 29. So there's literally nowhere you could stand except on Route 29. Which they can prevent you from doing, of course, because then you're interfering with traffic. And so, essentially, you have no ability to get to your audience as a politician. That is, direct ability to talk to and hand literature to. So our argument is that under the Virginia Constitution ought to be interpreted to extend free speech rights beyond traditional public forums and into, in a limited way, forums such as sidewalks and shopping malls. It's a difficult argument. Some states have interpreted their constitution that way. A couple of states have actually passed laws, New Jersey for one, I believe, that define exactly what these sort of limited public forums are at private shopping centers. As I'm sure you know, the U.S. Supreme Court some time ago, in a case out of California, said that the U.S. Constitution does not, First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution does not protect the right that you're talking about here. That only goes to traditional public forums, public property. However, there is nothing wrong with a state extending those rights if it chooses to, through legislation or through interpretation of its own state constitution. And so that's what we're asking for in this particular case. The Rutherford Institute has joined us in that case. The other case we're doing with the Rutherford Institute involves the Freedom of Information Act and the right of prisoners, people who are incarcerated in Virginia's prison, to use that. Did you talk about that at all last week? Because I know that Steve Rosenfield is working on that case too. Okay. The Virginia legislature passed a law a few years back saying that if you are incarcerated in one of Virginia's prisons, then you cannot use the Freedom of Information Act. The Freedom of Information Act, as you know, applies to everybody. You don't have to have any particular standing. You just ask for the information and it comes. So the assumption is that anyone can use the Freedom of Information Act to get public documents from the government. But what Virginia did was say, yes, anyone unless you are a prisoner. And our argument basically is, it's a hard one because, as you probably know, while there is a sort of broad assumption through the right to petition and other rights granted by the First Amendment that we do have right to these public documents, that Freedom of Information Acts, whether they are state or federal, are statutory. They are not constitutionally mandated. And so there's nothing in our Constitution that says that when government meets, that those meetings have to be open to the public. There's nothing in the Constitution that says when there are government documents that are created, they have to be made available to the public, except the Freedom of Information Act. So our problem is that we have a hard time making a First Amendment argument on behalf of prisoners. We can make an equal protection argument, though, that's one of the arguments that we're making. The state passed this law presumably because prisoners abuse the Freedom of Information Act, and actually, by asking for documents over and over and over again, the truth is there's no evidence of that whatsoever. The Freedom of Information Act is protected from abuse by the fact that government agencies can charge you for what you ask. They can charge a reasonable price. So one, if a prisoner is asking for documents, they have to pay the same amount of money I would for the same documents. The other, of course, is because they have to pay money for it and because they don't have money, they're less likely to ask for this sort of thing than most people. There's no evidence whatsoever that prisoners abuse the Freedom of Information Act in any way. Yet the Virginia General Assembly is sort of part of a spate of laws and policies passed by the Department of Corrections sort of cracking down on prisoners' rights passed this particular law. Our case is a compelling case, at least in one regard. We are representing a man named Joe Gerontano. Gerontano, like over 30% of the prisoners in Virginia, has hepatitis C. Because if you go into the Virginia prison system, you will probably, you have like a 30 to 40% chance of picking up hepatitis C once you're there. It is of epidemic proportions within the prison. Hepatitis C is very expensive to treat. And as you probably know, the court cases interpreting the obligations of prisoners to prisons to give medical treatment to prisoners are particularly bad in this area, the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals. And so the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals has set as the threshold deliberate indifference. Unless the state is being deliberately indifferent to a medical problem that a prisoner is having, then they can get by with not doing anything. What the Department of Corrections has is a protocol for treatment of hepatitis C, and it's a sort of harsh, almost triage kind of protocol. What it says that if you are young enough and healthy enough, we're going to give you the treatment because we think we can do something about it. It's very expensive treatment. It's something like $18,000 a year to treat people for hepatitis C. But if you have a history of alcohol abuse or drug abuse, if you're still using drugs, it's a very sort of complicated and long protocol. But the point is that some people get good treatment, some people don't get any treatment at all, some people get sort of treatment in between. And so for a prisoner, where they stand in terms of how they're evaluated under this protocol can be a matter of life and death. So Gerontano has hepatitis C. He's getting treatment at a certain level. What he wants to know is he getting the treatment that meets the protocol? Is he getting everything he's supposed to get under Virginia guidelines? So he writes and says, I want to know what the guidelines are, and I want to know, you know, what the treatment availability is. I want to know if I'm getting the right treatment. And they say, sorry, you can't use the Freedom of Information Act. We're not going to give it to you. So a prisoner in the Virginia system can't get the guidelines for treatment of his disease because of this particular law. That's our case. We'll just have to see what happens with that. And the Rutherford Institute has joined us on that case. So let me go back now that I've sort of given you this sense of how the ACLU and the Rutherford Institute sort of can operate together, apart mostly, and occasionally on directly opposite sides from each other in a case. The ACLU is like the Rutherford Institute, a private, nonprofit organization. There are about 500,000 members, and our income is generated almost entirely from membership contributions. I say membership contributions. Membership contributions and additional contributions from those members that are tax deductible. The 500,000 members are paying an average of about $50 each to be members. Actually, membership is only $20, but the average person donates about $50. And that generates a whole lot of income for the organization. But all of those people are asked to give more. Those donations to the ACLU as a membership organization are not tax deductible. But you can make tax-deductible donations to the ACLU Foundation, which is the part of the ACLU that does the litigation and public education. And so we go back to those same people and ask for more money. And the vast, vast majority, of course, are like most people. They're members, and that's as much as they're going to give. But there's some people who give more. And there are a lot of people who give, you know, a few $100s. And a few people who give a few thousand, and a few people that give a lot more than that. To give you an idea about how that works in Virginia, 9,000 of the 500,000 ACLU members live in Virginia. Our total budget here is about $500,000. We get every member piece of the money goes 30% of the donation from every member goes to the national office, 70% stays in the state, and then there's other money, the tax deductible money, that's split 50-50 between the state office and the national office. So in Virginia, for example, we have our 9,000 members giving about $50 each. We have about 500 of those give donations of between $400 and $600 or $700, and another dozen or so will top the 1,000 to 2,000 mark. We have one donor that typically gives us between $20,000 and $30,000 a year. Another donor who gives us about $20,000. Another who gives us about $15,000. So I can count the really big donors, you know, on one hand with a couple of fingers left over. But then there are a lot of people in between. And that's how you sort of put together an organization like this. Money is shared with National and the state affiliate. The National ACLU is located in New York with a large legislative office in D.C. Each state has an affiliate like the Virginia affiliate. And each state operates independently with its own board of directors, its own corporate status, and much of the fundraising I just described is done by the states themselves because we're the ones that are closest to those donors. The typical breakdown would be that the national office does all the all the major solicitation of membership, that 500,000. We then work the 9,000 in Virginia to look for those who can give more and establish more personal relationships with them to try to get the larger donations, which ultimately make up about half of our budget. I just described a fairly typical nonprofit advocacy organization. I think the very similar to Planned Parenthood or NAACP or organizations, any number of organizations. So what this does is give us a presence in each state. In the ACLU's, if the ACLU is different from a lot of other national organizations, I'll give you an example like Common Cause or Sierra Club, it is that the states are far more, the state offices are far more independent. We make all of our own decisions about litigation, all of our own decisions about public education, all of our own decisions about lobbying with our own board of directors and our own staff. The national office occasionally does not like what affiliates do and will tell them. But outside of actually doing something so outrageous that the national office would remove our charter, we operate very independently. That really works because the ACLU is an organization that does public education, lobbying, and litigation. Our reputation is largely built on litigation, and as you know, litigation is almost always local. Now, recently there have been some big constitutional cases that really start at the national level, primarily because of the Patriot Act and because of all the expansion of executive powers, invasion of privacy, and I'm happy to talk about any of those that you want. We've had some big cases, but most of the cases, if you think about all the Supreme Court cases that you've studied, most of them started locally. They started with Rich Collins at a shopping mall, and that issue goes all the way up to the Supreme Court, which has to decide whether or not shopping malls are public forums or not. Now, in this case, it's already made that decision, so that case is probably not going in that direction. But most of the big cases in the U.S. Supreme Court started locally. So And for the ACLU, having that local presence, having the ability to make independent decisions locally about which cases we will file or not file is extremely important. And as the cases go up the line and head toward the Supreme Court, that's when the national office will start to get involved. It even at that point, though, other than offering resources, doesn't have the power to change the direction that an ACLU affiliate takes. I think one of the things, as I described how the ACLU had a dilemma in something like the Rosenberger case, where there were two sides to it, there's another issue of sort of recent vintage that has split the ACLU in a similar way, and this is hate crimes legislation. Many states, starting in the early 1990s, began to pass legislation creating enhanced penalties for crimes motivated by race or religion, national origin, some cases sexual orientation or gender. And the idea, of course, is that if someone commits a crime against someone else, then they are punished for that crime, assault, for example. But if the crime was motivated by, say, racial animus, then the crime can carry enhanced penalties. The two sides of that for the ACLU are, one, the ACLU is very much a civil rights organization. Within the context of the issues that I've talked about, like free speech and separation of church and state, and of course we go to cruel and unusual punishment, due process, all the principles articulated in the Bill of Rights. The ACLU ends up, in this particular case, believing that none of those rights I just described have meaning unless they apply equally to all. And so that puts us as both sort of civil libertarians who want to protect these individual rights and liberties, but also strong civil rights advocates who believe those liberties and rights are only meaningful if they are protected by civil rights laws. So on one hand, you have us as kind of libertarians in the sense that the government should not be, should only reluctantly interfere with what people do. The kinds of decisions people make about actions and speech and all the rest. And on the other hand, we believe that those rights are meaningless unless they are apply to all equally. Well, you take those two principles and you put it and you take a look at hate crimes legislation, and we have a problem. The ACLU would obviously be supportive of hate crimes legislation in the same way we are of all the civil rights laws. On the other hand, hate crimes legislation punishes someone for essentially their thought or their ideas. And we're not saying don't punish those individuals because they assaulted someone. That's a legitimate application of criminal law. But you cannot enhance the penalties simply because their motivation was based on thought that we think is protected by the First Amendment of the Constitution. ACLUs have split on that issue. The ACLUs at different states have come to different conclusions on this particular issue. And there have actually been two U.S. Supreme Court decisions where the ACLU have filed amicus briefs on two different sides. Rosenberger, at least we decided by a narrow vote which side we were on, understanding that we had a sort of personality split as we went into it, but knowing ultimately that the democratic rule of the organization put us on one side or the other. But hate crimes legislation, because they emanated out of these state different state offices, brought very different opinions, and the ACLU literally, in a couple of hate crimes cases that went to the Supreme Court, filed amicus briefs on both sides. There is a lot of argument within the organization that we should not be doing that, that we undermine our own purpose by actually arguing both sides of the same case. The other is that we're a strong enough organization that understands those complexities that that we can argue both sides of the cases. The ACLU has had more cases before the Supreme Court than any other individual or entity or law firm in the history of the United States. We've won 56% of them. which says to me we could flip a coin. I mean, it's amazing. It's almost 50-50. Well, I almost don't know how to interpret the 56%. On one hand, it says, well, you know, we're right some of the time, but we're not right other time. Other time, it seems like, well, you know, that's just so close to flipping a coin. I wonder, how right we are. The underpinnings of the ACLU, it began as a litigating organization, is still primarily a litigating organization, even though we do lots of other advocacy work. What that means is, though, we are accustomed to the way the judicial system works, and that is two sides staking out their arguments and letting a jury or judge decide who's right. And so we're very comfortable with taking one of those sides on any particular issue, and we're often comfortable with the outcome even when we lose. And Rosenberger was an example. I swear, when Rosenberger came down against us, not on our side, there were more people happy in the ACLU about that than there were who were upset about it. And even those who had written the brief, the amicus brief, thought that the decision from the Supreme Court was a thoughtful decision. It really may not have been the wrong decision in the end. So that gives you an idea of sort of how we operate. Another example that I'll give of how we sort of move along the sort of ideological spectrum is Jerry Falwell. Not only do we at the same time have cases on either side with the Rutherford Institute, we recently completed two cases involving Jerry Falwell. One of those cases was Falwell's challenge to the Virginia constitutional ban on incorporation of churches. Falwell had run into some problems because of that plus statute that limits the amount of land that churches can own. These are 200-year-old provisions in the Virginia Constitution and the Virginia Code that were put there at a time where the Virginia governing body had strong concern about the power of churches. We were talking about the transition from the Church of England, the official Church of England, and so they not only were, you know, part and parcel of the Establishment Clause and the Free Exercise Clause, but created very specific provisions in the Virginia Constitution and Code to make sure that churches didn't get too powerful. They probably looked fair at the time when churches owned huge amounts of land, had a huge amount of power within the political structure of Virginia. But right now what it looks like is that they're discriminated against. If you are because a church is a nonprofit organization, or most churches choose to be nonprofit organizations recognized by the federal state government, and that gives them certain parameters in which they can operate. Other nonprofit organizations can incorporate. Other nonprofit organizations can own land over 250. That's also a very sort of complicated thing. There's no limit on the amount of land that nonprofit organizations can own, but religious institutions cannot. So we assisted Jerry Falwell in that case, challenging the Virginia statute and constitution. We won the case in federal court. The Virginia General Assembly, as you may know, passed for the second time this year the amendment to the Virginia Constitution that will remove the ban on incorporating churches. And when you go to the polls in November, you will actually see that on your ballot. That will be right there by the gay marriage amendment. And, of course, the ACLU says vote yes for the first one and no for the second one, but that's another issue we can talk about later if you want. At the same time that we joined Jerry Falwell in that case, we also defended someone sued by Jerry Falwell. And this was a guy who put up a website called Falwell.com. F-A-L-L-W-E-L-L. He misspelled his name by one L, put up a website, and if you're sort of Googling for Falwell, you're likely to run into this guy's website. And it's a website that pokes fun at Jerry Falwell, mostly attacks him for his position, his anti-gay and lesbian positions, has lots of quotes and things like that from him. Falwell sued, And I mainly going with, he knew, I think, he couldn't really go with any kind of defamation case. He's a public figure. He's already been through that in some other cases anyway. He's a public figure, and this guy has a right to poke fun at him in the same way that a newspaper editorial or a newspaper cartoonist, editorial cartoonist can draw pictures at that poke fun at Jerry Falwell. So he went largely on the trademark issue, trademark violation. We argued that the First Amendment protected this guy's right to put up a website that pokes fun at Jerry Falwell. I mean, it's that simple. And we prevailed in that case. So with Falwell, we were also on the both sides of the same case at the same time. I mean, two different sides with the same organization. Does anybody have any questions? I'm really getting tired of talking. Yes.
I have a question regarding the housing occupancy laws and how they affect illegal immigrants. And I read the article where you were quoted and you said that they were xenophobic and discriminatory. But then I was also thinking back online how if you do have overcrowding in houses where there are too many people, how that would be a fire code or safety violation, present parking problems or devalue the property. It seems to me that overcrowding in general, not just for immigrants, would be a bad idea. And so I think zoning ordinances should be allowed.
And as you probably know, there's a long case history about zoning ordinances, race discrimination, the recent ones we call anti-immigrant ordinances. And of course, your reference is to the ordinance passed by Manassas, City of Manassas, last December. And this has, like a lot of things, a number of different threads going through it. It was clear to us from our understanding of the discussion and the ordinance that was passed that it was an anti-immigrant ordinance. It was an ordinance motivated by the fact that there's a growing immigrant population in Manassas, and there's a lot of xenophobia about it. Now, that's our sort of sense of the origins of that ordinance, but did not have anything to do with our legal argument against the ordinance. The ordinance was not the ACLU does not oppose and would never interfere with the right of a locality to create an ordinance that restricts the number of people who can live in a given space. I mean, this is done all the time. Now, there's a point where it could be unreasonable. Right, you could say, you know, only one person per every 3,000 square feet, and that would be, an unreasonable ordinance because it clearly doesn't serve any health or safety means. But but in this instance, what they did was they didn't pass a neutral. They didn't say, listen, there are too many people living in. We have too much overcrowding. And our current ordinance, because they already had an ordinance that deals with the number of people who can live in place, our current ordinance isn't effective. We need to go back and tweak the ordinance to make sure that we are, because of, I don't know why, a car, the proliferation of cars, any number of reasons that you could go back and use as a rational basis a more restrictive code for the number of people who can live together, within a certain square footage. That's sort of the typical way of doing it. But what they didn't do it that way, though. What they did was they restricted the number of the relatives who can live together by nature of their relationship to each other. Okay, that's what the code said. And basically the code said that husband and wife can live in a house together with their kids, and a grandparent, but not an uncle, or not a cousin, and it's an ordinance that defines what family means, rather than being a neutral ordinance dictating the number of people that can live in a certain space. It dictated how families can live together. The reason they wrote the ordinance that way, according to our sources, is that Hispanic families. Immigrant families in general, but particularly Hispanics that are Latinos that are moving into, tend to live as large family units. If too many people live in too small a space. It doesn't matter if it's mother, father, and their kids. I mean, you know, the city can prevent them from doing that. But what this did was not, it's not based on square footage. It's based on the relationship. And it, clearly the motivation was to target Hispanic families. What we found, of course, that helped us out in our legal arguments against this was a U.S. Supreme Court case from the 1970s. It says essentially under the 14th Amendment substantive due process that the government doesn't have a right to define your family in that regard. I mean, obviously you can define it in terms of benefits and things like that. But in terms of living together, that's a decision that families get to make and get to decide. So Manassas can have an ordinance saying no more than five people in 5,000 square feet, but it can't have an ordinance that says your cousin can't live with you under the same roof as a family member. If that neutral ordinance prevents the cousin from living there, that's fine. But they can't go in that direction. We had a Supreme Court case, happily, in this instance. We were opposed to the ordinance, period. Luckily, we had a Supreme Court case on our side. We brought that to the attention of Manassas officials, threatened a lawsuit, and they repealed the ordinance.
What about, I remember reading about a law in Virginia that says you can't have your children, like if they're a boy and a girl, you can't have them in the same room. They're supposed to have their own room. But isn't that also like defining how?
Yeah, and that's an interesting question. I don't know about that law. Yeah, there are a lot of old laws floating around. Virginia, still has on the books its cohabitation law. It's against Virginia to lewdly and lasciviously cohabitate. So if you are not married and living together lewdly and lasciviously, then that's against the law. That law really can't be applied. Ever since the Lawrence v. Texas case, the sodomy case that went to the U.S. Supreme Court, it's clear that that case, sort of like the case that I just referred to, are ones where the Supreme Court has recognized the right of individuals to make decisions about their private relationships, and the government can't interfere with those, particularly within their own homes. So I don't know about that. That would be very interesting. I don't even know the Virginia law you're talking about. You know, every year we learn about old Virginia laws that have been sitting around that are either not applied or haven't really affected anyone for a while. Do you know the law in particular
No, I'll look it up.
Right. I would think that it's the sort of thing where we give the state wide berth when it comes to protecting children. And so you both have the strain or the tension between the right of parents to determine the upbringing of their children and the right of the state to protect children, and that's how you end up with child abuse laws and all the rest. I'm trying to think of an argument that the state would make for at some certain age, for example, requiring separate bedrooms based on gender. But boy, that's a hard argument. But if you find that law, tell me. We'll go look at it and see.
You mentioned Lawrence. Is that pretty much the unholy grail for the ACLU? I mean, this language about a moral disapprobation being an illegitimate basis for law. I mean, is that? That looks like the world the ACLU envisions.
Well, yeah. Well, I mean, first of all, we understand that they're operating off. The assumption is that most lawmakers are operating from with moral antennas of their own, and our laws, as you can see from looking at them, certainly come. Out of those basic sort of law, from those basic moral grounds, but the answer is yes, that laws that the government should, the government has a right to restrict what individuals do. I'll go back to sort of libertarian principle, because if we do start there, I think it sort of answers your question. That sort of the libertarian principle we start with is that Everybody, in a free society, everybody should be able to do what they want. You know, and that's the beginning. And then you layer laws on that as you restrict behavior or you restrict people's action so as to hold the fabric of society together. For example, if you said, if you didn't have a law saying you couldn't rob banks, that would be pretty screwy. And being, and so what's the basis for not robbing banks? The basis for not robbing banks is that our whole system would begin to fall apart if it were legal to rob banks. So we do have laws put in place to sort of keep the fabric of society together, but they're not necessarily based on anything more than the utilitarian or practical principle. And that it's very important that government not tell people what their morality should be, although we understand that laws are made by moral people based on their moral principles.
But how is it that morals, I mean, in the ACLU seems determined to eradicate particularly Christian viewpoints from the public square, leaving, as I mean, you've given it a name, it's utilitarian, it's Kantian, it's a cost-benefit analysis or a, you know, greatest good or whatever for the greatest number. I mean, that, how is that not an establishment of a secular religion?
Well, first of all, of course, I'll take issue with your premise that we're trying to wipe Christianity from the public square.
Well, you can take issue with it, over here, your case.
Right,
there's a lot of evidence out there.
What's that?
There's a lot of evidence out
right.
there.
And there's a lot of evidence to the contrary, too. The ACLU, if you look at the cases that we've taken, we have actually more cases defending people's right to free exercise of religion than we do establishment clause.
Yeah, I don't mean cases. To take exception with free exercise. I mean
right.
the public square. I mean
right.
the Ten Commandments and I'm talking about the government, this sort of abnormal expansion of establishment clause
right.
territory that these things put.
Yeah. Well, and now you're getting into a very tiny area because I do want to answer that. I do want to defend our position, so to speak. I mean, for example, one of the things that you may have seen is that there was a big hullabaloo a couple of years ago when the Falmouth Public Park refused to allow a minister to use the river that runs through the park to baptize people. The government official actually thought he was doing the right thing by saying, no, you can't use a public park for religious ceremonies. That violates the Establishment Clause. But we jumped all over him for that. We defended the right in that public park of that minister to conduct baptisms in the same way that we would defend anybody's right to free exercise in that public park. The ACLU is not trying in any way, shape, or form to wipe religion or Christianity out of the public square. What we do believe, though, is that 200-plus years after we got the First Amendment of the Constitution, that this tandem of separation of church and state and free exercise of religion has left us as the most religiously free and diverse nation in the world. And we believe that the Establishment Clause, I believe that the Establishment Clause is a subset of the Free Exercise Clause, that free exercise doesn't work unless you keep government out of religion. Because government, I'm sure you've all read Madison's Memorial and Remonstrance, the tendency of government to abuse its power, particularly if it's operating off particular religious principles, historically, is clearly there. And it's a danger that the founders felt, and it's a danger that's still there. And, for example, we are not a Christian nation, right? We're a nation of many different religions. We're becoming more diverse all the time. And every one of those religions has the same right to exist. Every one of those individuals practicing those religions has the same right to practice that religion. If the government begins to endorse a particular religion, then that renders all other religions secondary. I mean, it's and part of it is the message coming out of the government, and the other is the natural sort of practical implications of that. So I believe that the ACLU's strong feelings about the Establishment Clause emanate from our strong feelings about free exercise of religion. And we may disagree when it comes down to, for example, Hashmel Turner. Hashmel Turner is sitting in this place where I think he could move a couple inches one way and legitimately give that prayer, and the ACLU would defend his right to do it. But right now, Hashmel Turner is... he opens city council with an official government prayer. He is the voice of the government when he delivers that prayer. And I know you're disagreeing with that. And because he is the voice of the government, he should not be delivering a sectarian prayer. I think that if city council of Fredericksburg arranged this differently, for example, if it opened its meetings with a message from members of city council of their choice, not prayer. It says right there on the agenda, it's a prayer. It's a prayer of Fredericksburg City Council. It is so. So Hashmel Turner is speaking for Fredericksburg when he gives that prayer. If they can change that, even if it's a small change, so that when he gives his prayer, he is simply stating his own particular views, and that's clear, it's not the city's views, then I think he can do that and we would defend his right. When I wrote him the letter I wrote him, I said, listen, as a formal prayer, when you become the voice of the city of Fredericksburg, you can't give a sectarian prayer. But you have a right at any other time during deliberations of city council, you can say, I'm voting for this particular ordinance because I'm a Christian and I'm motivated by Christian values, and because I think it promotes Christianity. He can say that absolutely no problem whatsoever. It's clear that he is speaking for himself. So our only argument is when those prayers become the prayers of the government. And the Ten Commandments cases, of course, from our perspective, were exactly that. In both instances, these were Ten Commandments placed on government grounds or government buildings. And of course the Supreme Court kind of split the baby with it, and we end up with these two cases, I think, that tell us that the Supreme Court is still unclear about this issue. That's what I think. I think they really didn't know how to answer this. Maybe they've given us guidelines. Maybe they've given us guidelines for the future, but I have trouble looking at these two cases like you looked at the Lemon case and say, okay, here are the criteria, let's see if we can apply them. Of course, the Supreme Court's had trouble applying Lemon too, so, yes.
I wanted to know what exact part of Hashmel's prayer does the ACLU have a problem with, because I haven't heard his prayers. And what would be an example of a prayer that the ACLU would be okay with?
First of all, I will go back one step back, because the ACLU really doesn't really like this whole government prayer thing, whether it's sectarian or non-sectarian. And fine, I find the sectarian, non-sectarian issue one of the most problematic, because it's the government defining what a prayer is. And the fact that the government actually is telling people, you can pray, but here's what your prayer must look like, I find very, very problematic. Of course, our answer to that is that you probably shouldn't open government meetings with a prayer at all. But that's not the Supreme Court's position on it, and we're not fighting that. The ACLU hasn't been bringing cases fighting non-sectarian prayers at government meetings. And as I tell people, we're not the prayer police. We don't go around a government meeting listening to prayers, wondering who's going to say what, and then coming down on people that say anything. We only react when we get complaints about this. The difference is, not in terms of what the ACLU finds okay or not okay, because we find the whole prayer, non-sectarian prayer, not okay, to be quite frank. But the issue between sectarian and non-sectarian is simply whether or not a particular religion is referenced in the prayer. And so there are lots of non-sectarian prayers where there are references made to a supreme being. There's no doubt that there are, like I said, all kinds of questions with sectarian, non-sectarian prayers. But non-sectarian references, for example, typically reference a supreme being, God, Lord. We have, you know, in God we trust on our coins. We reference God in the Pledge of Allegiance, which was, as you well know, sort of inserted there by Congress in the 1950s. So we have what the courts have accepted is this notion that we are a religious country, and that people are going to wear their religion on their sleeve. It's going to be part of our public documents. But what we can't do is divide people along religious lines by having those religious references in any way, shape, or form be sectarian. And of course, the obvious one is a reference to Jesus or a Christian reference. And that's what Hashmel Turner does. His prayers differ every time. Sometimes he simply ends with "In Christ's name." But once you say "In Christ's name," you've said everything that precedes this, involves Christ or involves Christianity. But there are lots of different ways of doing that. Does that answer your question? Okay. Yes.
I'll get back to what you were addressing John's question. You said that you believe that the Establishment Clause can kind of work hand in hand and not be in conflict with the Free Exercise Clause, and I completely agree with you. One of my questions is, let me talk about a different case that's one of our cases in Nevada. It's the Brittany McComb case. You may or may not be familiar with
it. I might, if you just, I certainly don't know by name.
It's a valedictorian address where the valedictorian was given an opportunity to discuss, the guidelines given to her was to discuss why she did so well, what gave her the ability to do so well, and so on and so forth. Well, answering her question, in her speech, she was going to discuss how God was at the center of that. To her, that was absolutely the center of her success. So, as she was giving the speech, the plug was literally pulled by a school principal, or a teacher.
Right.
So that's the case. The ACLU, interestingly, I'm not sure if they made a final decision in Nevada ACLU, whether they're going to or not, but the reports are that they're looking like they're going to. They're
going to.
Times of government. My question.
Well, but before you ask the question, because this issue has come up here, and similar issues have come up here, and like a lot of these, you end up in this very, sort of very narrow space. The ACLU in Virginia would probably come down on her side. Yeah. Okay.
It doesn't take sustain by my question then.
Well, that's all right but barely. Okay. And maybe reluctantly.
Because my question still is addressable. It's the American Civil Liberties Union is just that. They're for civil liberties. And so, when you have a close call, should you not, as a civil libertarian organization, come on the side of the individual and say, government, you're not going to interfere with this person's speech? Even with Hashmel Turner, I think the same thing applies. You admitted yourself that it's a relatively close call.
And so, it's a relatively close call, and I hate the fact that we're not representing, because we're amicus in the case, but that we're on the side of the government in this case. I mean, it makes me uncomfortable, because we're typically on the other side.
Right.
Yeah. And these high school speeches or prayers and all sorts of things, are very complicated. We've discussed this because, as you may know, there was a whole evolution, the whole post-Levy-Wiseman evolution that took place. And for you guys, if you haven't studied Levy-Wiseman, that's the Supreme Court decision saying that you can't have you can't invite a clergy person into a high school graduation ceremony to give a prayer. And what happened after that, of course, disrupted tradition in a lot of places, not just in Virginia but across the country, that had typically brought in clergy to do that. What happened was the first reaction to that was a number of schools went to what they call student-initiated prayers. And this was where students decided whether or not they wanted to have prayer by vote, and then a student delivered the prayer at the graduation ceremony, and the prayer was non-sectarian. And the truth is the Supreme Court's never actually addressed that issue. It's been up to a couple of the circuits. One of the first places to do this kind of student-initiated prayer in reaction to Levi Wiseman was Loudoun County here in Virginia. The parents of some students and students came to us and asked us to sue the school to prevent them from doing it, which we did. And we prevailed in that case basically saying that this was no different from Levi Wiseman. It's simply that you sort of manufactured or fabricated it in a different way. And so once we got that, we notified schools in Virginia that, by the way, if a federal district court in Virginia didn't go up. The school chose not to appeal the case. Federal district judge in Virginia has ruled that you can't, that this kind of prayer is essentially the same as Levi Wiseman. You can't do it. So schools came back with the next year. In fact, I'll never forget this. Henrico County School Board called a press conference. And at the press conference, they said, when the person giving the speech, the valedictorian address, talks, if they give a prayer, if they do a prayer, we're not going to interfere with it. And so he announced that. And so it was sort of the next phase of how the schools that wanted to maintain the tradition of a prayer at graduation ceremonies were dealing with the Levi Wiseman aftermath. The schools expected us to react. I got a call from the chair of the school board saying, well, I guess you guys are going to come out with something saying, you know, we can't do this. And I said, no, I think you can do this. You know, what you really ought to do to do it right is at graduation, tell the valedictorian or whoever is speaking that they have 10 minutes to say what they want and that you're not going to interfere with that. And that's the purest way to do it. Now, you can imagine how nervous that makes school principals. And that's the dilemma for them. Most the school officials want the students to be able to do something like pray if they want to. On the other hand, they don't want to give them total right to say anything they want, because these are special occasions that are orchestrated, you know, beginning to end. It's part of the Levi Wiseman decision is understanding that school graduations are very orchestrated by the school. They essentially control everything that takes place, including they have the right, no doubt, to control the content of student speech there. But they don't have to do it. So we have generally leaned in favor of when a school lets someone speak. So if that person spoke in that context, we wouldn't come down. Now, you said the Nevada ACLU hasn't decided yet.
Last I saw in the news reports, they hadn't decided. Okay. It looked like it was fairly likely they would come on the side of the government.
Yeah. It doesn't surprise me. But you'll see that the ACLUs are different in that regard. ACLUs are sort of democratically run organizations, and while we're operating off these principles, different people, as you can see, can disagree about them. And so different ACLUs have sort of different personalities. And the personality of the ACLU in Virginia tends to run more toward the libertarian side of things, and so we were less likely to do anything about that. We didn't get involved. You guys had a case, I think it was a lawsuit. I don't know if you just got involved. Several years ago, someone was doing a song at a graduation ceremony called The Prayer. Do you know what I'm? Does anyone know what I'm talking about? Okay. Anyway. Yeah. I think the Rutherford Institute. I think he actually represented the student who wanted to sing the song called "The Prayer" at the graduation ceremony. We didn't get involved in that.
Doesn't this school issue here, though, really kind of it transcends whether the student in that case wanted to give a speech based on her faith in God is what's guiding her, versus the government, school authorities, what you were characterizing, which seems right, to their right to regulate the speech of any student in the context of an official event at the school. It seems to me it's almost irrelevant as to whether or not it's a reference to God or not, because if the student has the absolute right to free speech in that, they could get up and say some amazing things,
right.
Which almost anybody in the audience might be repelled by. And so, because the student is still a minor and still, you know, or under the aegis of the government entity, that government entity has an absolute right to control the speech of the student. Isn't that really what it's about?
Well, the Supreme Court has said that. You know, if you look at things like the Hazelwood case, things like that, Supreme Court basically has said, you know, the students don't have free speech rights other than tinker.
They can't engage in viewpoint discrimination, though.
No, they can't, right. And then I was going in that direction. That's right. So the dilemma for the school, right, the dilemma for the school is they say, first of all, the school can essentially script the whole thing. I mean, they would have that right to do that if they wanted. But if they go to this speech and they look at the speech and say, well, you can include this and you can't include that, and they are involved in viewpoint discrimination, then you've got a problem. Because you don't want the school to come in and say, okay, well, you can say Republicans are good and Democrats are bad. And the problem with speech, if it goes to religion, is that now you end up with this, with viewpoint discrimination bumping up against the Establishment Clause. And so the question has to be there, whose words are they? You know, and if the school is basically saying these are the students' words, we're going to look at the speech, because we're looking for a certain kind of message or something like that. They clearly can do that, but they should not tell the student not to mention religion, because that's viewpoint discrimination. I agree with that. What I think schools ought to do is a disclaimer. I also think that's a wise thing to do. Let a student speak. Let them make these kinds of references, but just make it clear that the student is speaking his or her. But the real dilemma comes in where the school has the right to control to some extent what's in that speech, obviously, as we said, but how do they do it without viewpoint discrimination? Really hard is what it is. And like I said, we tend to come down on the side of let the student speak. We've not come down on any school that allowed a student ultimately to incorporate religious references into a speech. From our perspective, a lot of the issue is perception. And you see the Supreme Court talking about perception in school cases. What is the audience thinking? Assumption one, that the audience is captive or sort of coerced, at least to some extent, that it's a graduation ceremony. And what is their perception of the speech that's coming from the front? And I think with the clergy, inviting the clergy in, the perception was the school invited a religious official in to stand here and give a prayer. That clearly looks like the school's endorsing that. But allowing a student to talk about their personal life, I think that most people in the audience can make that distinction. You know, and say, no, this isn't the school. You know, this is Jane. This is Jane's views. Helps if the school makes it clear that it's Jane's view, and then you can probably deal with that. Yes?
Just against school and religion, does the ACLU take a stance on, like, intelligent design at all? And what stance is that?
Yeah, in fact, the intelligent design case out of Pennsylvania,
that was
ACLU case, right, yeah. So, you can talk intelligent design forever. The ACLU stand on intelligent design in that particular case was that, and it's what the judge found in the case too, is that that was clearly motivated by religion. That was attempting to put intelligent design in the school with a religious purpose. And the judge found, lots of facts supporting that. The harder intelligent design argument is that if you can, is having intelligent design in a school where you, for some reason or another, could not show a religious purpose. Then you have to show religious effects, which is very hard with intelligent design. You know, there's a case right now that Americans United has out of Georgia about the textbook sticker case.
Right.
You know what I'm talking about?
Cobb County.
What is it?
Cobb County,
right, yeah. And it's one where the school board had a sticker put on the biology book saying, what does it say? It just said, it's not a real strong statement. It's something like,
There might be alternative theories.
Yeah. Theories to evolution. Right. You have a right to make your own mind or something like that. Right, yeah. They're going to have to show, and Americans United is doing that case. They're going to have to show a religious purpose. And I suppose, yeah.
Or I was going to say, why is religious motivation seen as so bad, or maybe I'm not understanding exactly what the religious motivation is that you're calling out, because, I mean, I feel like the people on the other side have just as much of a atheist or secular motivation, too. I mean, there's, it's not like they have an absence of motivation or agenda. I mean, I think those wanting to, you know, push intelligent design out of school also have the same motivation of, you know, discrediting religion. Well, so, I mean, I don't see how one side's motivation is so much worse than another side's motivation.
Well, and that makes the assumption that evolution and religion are incompatible. And we shouldn't do that, because evolution and religion are compatible for a lot of people.
But I think the people wanting to push out intelligent design, like those arguing that intelligent design should be taught, have the motivation of secularism. I'm not saying that those who believe in evolution are automatically secular or atheist. I'm saying that those who do not want intelligent design in their classroom,
I think it's
motivation of pushing out.
I think here's why I think we ended up with intelligent design. First of all, you can look at it as simply the next generation after creationism. You know, that it's a more, you know, looking at it in the most cynical way, it's an evolved creationism that has the pretense of having a more sort of secular backing to it, so that it can make its way into school. But let's
look at it in the most cynical way, though. Is it
from establishment clause perspective, right? That could be a motivation for it. Okay, but here's how I think we got to this bad place with things like intelligent design, our difficult case with intelligent design, is that schools have overreacted. You know, we teach math and English and science and, you know, all kinds of stuff in school. What we don't teach in school generally, in most high schools, is religion. We don't teach history of religion or comparative religion. You can get those courses in college, but how many people went to a high school that literally had a comparative religion course? And the truth is that religion, it looks weird to me to see science and geology and biology and even occasional philosophy course and English and history and all those things, and not see religion. I mean, religion is a significant part of world culture, particularly Western culture, and we kind of leave it out in our public schools. And the reason we do is because we haven't figured out how to deal with this, you know, in school. I mean, no one's come up with really good ways of doing it. The truth is, there are easy ways. You can teach comparative religion. But I think schools are afraid to do it because they're going to get into all those squirrely issues with the Establishment Clause and who teaches it and how they're taught. So because of our fear of violating the Establishment Clause, because of an unjustified fear of violating the Establishment Clause in public schools, based a lot on Supreme Court decisions, because, you know, all the decisions generally for the last 30, 40 years, almost all of them have come down on the Establishment Clause side, basically saying be very, very careful when you deal with the subject of religion in public schools. And so schools have gotten overly cautious about it, and so they're not teaching compared, and it's like a hole. It's a big hole. Now the problem comes with who's trying to get you to do it. If you look at intelligent design as one of the ways of sort of trying to get that back into a school, or you look at, we are starting to see a movement. You know, you've seen the new things on biblical literacy courses. There are somebody out of Princeton. I mean, there's a whole design for high school courses now on, like, teaching religion, how to do it. In a non-dogmatic way that we're starting to see. I think that would actually solve a lot of the problems, and I think the intelligent design argument kind of will go away, because intelligent design could actually be incorporated into those kind of courses.
I disagree. I feel like you're associating intelligent design with religion, but it's not. It's like a scientific theory held by, you know, very like qualified scientists. Yeah. I mean, yeah, although it might support a religious belief, to say that it is, it belongs in the religion category, I feel, is a wrong argument. I mean, I think it is scientific, and it does stay away from, I mean, it's very non-sectarian and everything. So, I mean, I have a hard time seeing why it's so bad to permit that in the school, like, to allow, you know, what a lot of qualified scientists see as an equally qualified scientific theory to be taught, and to snuff it out just because it seems to, you know, kind of encourage or validate religious belief. I mean, I feel like that's...
Well, Once again, we go to the issue of purpose, which can change depending. I mean, there are probably intelligent design backers who back it almost entirely for religious reasons, and there are plenty of people who back it for totally secular reasons. So it may indeed depend on why you're doing it. I have to take issue with, though, there are plenty of people who have written on intelligent design. There are plenty of smart scientists who've written on it. What it doesn't have yet, and maybe it will one day, okay, if people keep plugging away at it and keep refining their arguments, it does not yet have the same stature that evolution has and other science the way we teach in school. In other words, we accept every scientific theory, and let's include intelligent design as one, is open for debate. I mean, that's the nature of science, is that it's always open for debate. It's always open for disproving whatever your current hypothesis is. And any science that closes its door is not science. And so what we tend to teach in school are what the most accepted, where the evidence piles up the greatest, and we teach those things, and not just evolution, but on all kinds of different scientific men. It wasn't that long that we were teaching Newtonian science as the beginning and end of everything, natural laws, completely predictable, controlling everything, and all of a sudden we're discovering, quantum. We have quantum physics, and it's like, whoa, this is, everything's different. Some of it compatible with Newtonian physics, some not. Intelligent design, it is quite possible that that particular approach to evolution will gain ground, as more people write on it, as there's more research on it. But right now it doesn't have the same body of evidence that you have for evolution. So right now schools are justified in teaching that. I don't think there's anything wrong with a teacher in a biology class saying, this is what mainstream science tells us is what evolutionary theory is. I don't think there's any problem with a teacher saying, by the way, there are alternative theories, and intelligent design is one. I don't think that you should force a teacher to do that. I don't think you can force a teacher to do that yet.
That hypothetical you just gave, and a student's parent called and said, I'm offended that the teacher mentioned intelligent design. Which side do you think the ACLU would take?
Oh, if a...
exact hypo that you just gave, where the teacher says, evolution...
Oh, and so the parent calls and says, I don't...
It seems to me sort of like the Hashmell-Turner situation.
Well, I see it differently because I would say that if, that teacher, I have, as I said, we have no problem with a teacher talking about intelligence. Now, there are a couple of other sort of strains of thoughts. One is academic freedom, and that teachers, our sort of libertarian free speech perspective is that while teachers clearly have a curriculum to follow and all the rest, we like the idea of giving teachers some freedom to express their own opinions about things, and that would certainly include intelligent design. I don't see a problem with that. No, I think if you're trying to make draw a parallel between that and Hashmell-Turner, that's like Hashmell-Turner during the deliberations of city council saying, Jesus Christ, I'm voting for this because I think it fits with my Christian principles, and I believe in Jesus Christ. We'd be the first group to defend his right to do that, where he's individually expressing his opinion. That teacher individually saying, intelligence is, here's an alternative theory. The school says I have to teach, school rule is, this is accepted scientific principles regarding evolution. Here they are. Here's some other thoughts about evolution. I mean, and the truth is, even within evolution, evolutionary theory, there are lots of different schools of thoughts. For a long time we had these very linear notions about evolution, and now we see that the evolutionary bush, and it has all these quirky twigs going in different directions.
In relation to George Bush.
One more question: why is religious innovation so bad? Like, why is that like a controlling factor whether or not that should be taught? Is what I'm trying to understand.
Yeah, when I refer to the religious purpose, I'm referring to the Supreme Court decisions, where they tried to judge. Because I think that's the purpose test is kind of a problem. And of course, the Supreme Court finds a problem with some of the purpose stuff too. Sometimes it uses it, sometimes it doesn't. I think, personally, I don't think it really should matter too much about what the motivate. Legally speaking, that's one of the tests they're going to apply. But I don't think it matters that much whether someone's motivation is religion or not religion. The question is, should it be taught in school or not?
Well, let me bring some shape to that question.
Okay.
I think there's a good point. What if a teacher said, left out intelligent design altogether, didn't even mention the words, and said from a scientific point of view that there are some fundamental flaws with evolution, the key being the mechanism for evolution, what started evolution. But let's just assume, for the sake of the hypothetical, that the teacher absolutely had religious motivation in that. It's a purely scientific argument. Is there a problem?
I don't think so. Yeah, I really don't. I mean, I can't speak for, like, so, you know, you've sort of discovered that we sort of fall on the sort of libertarian side here, and I mean, there's a lot of discussion about this issue, and a lot of people feel, you know, very, very differently about it. I mean, you know, what I really like, actually, and this is what you won't like, is I like the idea that evolved out of Supreme Court cases, even though it isn't articulated specifically, of government neutrality on religion, which is what the Lemon Test is supposed to give us, actually. You know, that government is neutral on religion. And by being neutral on religion, we are left to make our own decisions about it. That the last thing you want is government telling you anything about religion. It isn't that easy, of course. Because so much of what we are, and traditions and legislative decisions, come from a religious background. But I like the idea of sort of looking at government and not thinking that it has any view on religion at all. But the Supreme Court does allow that. I mean, that's in that Marsh v. Chambers case, basically it says government can practice religion, and that's why, from a policy perspective, that I don't like that, and it also gets us into the sort of peculiarities of government literally dictating what that if it's going to be able to do religion, but on a limited scale, what's that religion look like? And now we got government defining religion, and government defined religion is this homogenized kind of nothing religion. Actually, you know, a lot of the most deeply religious people I know are very adamant about separation of church and state, because what they hate most of all is that sort of homogenized government religion that comes out of the Pledge of Allegiance and on currency and things like that. And they just find that offensive. Yes?
I was concerned because the discussion seems to be that anything non-Christian is considered secular. What I was curious about is what movements have come to the ACLU, not from an atheist perspective or a secular perspective, but actually a religion that is not Christian. How many motions or like lawsuits have come from that? A very specific, very religious background, but not the one that seems to be overlying of America.
Right. That's a good question. My first question, I'll give you an example of one that's Christian but a subset of Christianity: Jehovah's Witnesses. This is a woman that worked for the Department of Defense in wherever it is in Northern Virginia somewhere, and she was getting a promotion. The promotion made her a different level government worker. In order to get the next level, she had to take out an oath of allegiance to the Constitution. As a Jehovah's Witness, you know, much like the person in the Barnett case, the Pledge of Allegiance case from the 40s, she did not want to sign that oath because her religion says that she can only swear allegiance to God. And she came to us. We went to the Department of Defense and said, listen, she'll sign an oath. She just got to change the words a little bit, because the words as you, and when she'll sign, not an oath, she'll sign a statement saying she'll defend the Constitution of the United States. That's what it was, all it was asking. They would not change the words. I mean, it's just incredible how obstinate government bureaucrats can be on something like this. And so ultimately we had to file a lawsuit, and we won that case. Now, that doesn't really answer your question, because you asked for like non-Christians. Probably the case, the one that's come up the most recently, well, we got two going on right now. One is under the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act. We are defending the right of prisoners in Virginia to have hair as demanded by their religion. And some of these are Hindu, some Rastafarians, some Muslims. We have to do with facial hair and head hair, all of which are involved in their religious beliefs. And we have a case, as you probably know, RLUIPA, this is a case we filed about 4 years ago because the Department of Corrections policy that all prisoners have to have their hair, their face, their beards and head hair cut short. The case got hung up for about 4 years because of constitutional challenges to the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act. But we are, while they're not completely finished, the main thing is that there were Establishment Clause challenges to it. The Department of Corrections of Virginia said that law violated the Establishment Clause. And for those who don't know, the RLUIPA is a federal law that says you can't burden the if a place receives federal money, like state prisons and other kinds of institutions, you can't burden the religious practices of the persons that are institutionalized there without a compelling interest for doing so. Of course, DOC always says we have a compelling interest in that security. Yet we don't want you to have long hair or beards because you can hide contraband in it. So they've got an argument. The question is whether it's a compelling argument or not. So we're defending the right of those. None of those are Christians. They're all other religions where the hair issue comes up. And we're defending their right to have long hair. We had our hearing in court last week. Sort of their expert saying they had to have it, our expert saying that you don't need it for security purposes.
My question is, when discussion becomes about separation of religion and state, how much of that is actually coming from people of religions that aren't normally part of the state
right.
religion, as opposed to being atheist or completely secular?
Right. The well, and of course, the case, our case involving the Wiccan, the woman who wanted to pray before meetings in Chesterfield County, I think that goes to that point. I would say that it's interesting. This is a case where Chesterfield County opens its meetings with a prayer, but it invites a member of the clergy in to give those prayers. It abides by the Supreme Court rules that the prayer has to be non-sectarian, but it only allows on the list people who practice within the Judeo-Christian faith. At least that's what their written policy said. They expanded that to Muslims later on. But that meant if you were Hindu or Wiccan or anything else, that you were not allowed to pray. We represented a woman who's a Wiccan who wanted to come and pray. And that case reminds me, we lost that case in the Fourth Circuit, and the Supreme Court decided not to take the case. It reminds me of the Marsh v. Chambers case, where I described what I thought was a dilemma of the Supreme Court. Clear legal precedent says you can't have government prayer, but how within our culture, with this tradition of doing this, with it so deeply embedded, could the Supreme Court actually not allow government prayer? So it had to find a way to do it. In this instance, what the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals did, I think, was look and say, how could you have a government policy that says, I'm going to allow on this official government list for people to pray at meetings only people of certain religions and exclude people of other religions? I mean, that is just blatantly discriminatory. On the other hand, how can we allow a Wiccan to open a government meeting with? How can we have come to a decision that forces Chesterfield County to allow a witch, as they would see it, to open their meetings with a prayer? They came to a decision, sort of like in Marsh v. Chambers, I think, in this case, the Fourth Circuit, well, there's just no way. So we've got to find a way to allow them to discriminate on the basis of religion. We probably had more Wiccan-related issues in the last 5 or 6 years than any other. We had a number of cases involving Wiccans where the Wiccans wanted to be able to perform wedding ceremonies, and you have to be certified by a judge to do that. And the judges weren't allowing Wiccans to do it based on the fact that they didn't find Wicca to be a religion. Now, in the Chesterfield case, that wasn't the issue. They recognized that Wicca was a legitimate religion. But other local circuit court judges that issue these certificates would say, well, Wicca's not a religion, so I'm not going to let you perform wedding ceremonies. And in all of those, we ultimately won all of those cases. In this case, we had great help from the government. We showed that the military chaplain's manual shows military chaplains how to minister to Wiccans. So if the, you know, if the military can recognize Wicca and even sort of describe the parameters of the religion to its chaplains, then certainly a judge in Virginia ought to recognize Wicca as a religion. Okay. Oh, was there more than one? Oh, no, there are more than, okay. Okay, you've had your hand up.
Yeah, I'm just curious what the ACLU in Virginia is doing to deal with the crisis of providing indigent criminal defendants with effective counsel, especially capital defendants.
We lobby very hard. I mean, I've talked all about litigation today. We have a public education program, but we also have a lobbying program, and we've lobbied for years to get the law changed in Virginia on that. You had Steve Benjamin talk. I'm sure he talked about that that issue. And the reason that we get, how we intersect with this is that this whole notion, when I talked about civil rights laws, is that if you could say the First Amendment doesn't mean anything unless it applies to people of all race, religions, national origin, then a fair trial doesn't mean anything unless it applies to everybody regardless of income. We've been very adamant about that. We've pushed hard for the legislation. It's very hard to move it in Virginia. We made arguments in death penalty cases. We actually made ineffective assistance.
Are you trying to get pay raised for these court-appointed attorneys? It seems like the state will break the bank to try to get somebody prosecuted and execute them. Right. But they'll only pay a few $1,000 for a public defender to mount a defense.
Right. No, you're absolutely right. The fact is we only have public defenders for a small period of time. Worse than that is what they pay private sector attorneys to take these kinds of cases. But this is an issue that's high on our priority list. Unfortunately, we have not been able to find a lawsuit to sue the state to do this, although there may be such a case. We're actually working with a D.C. firm right now that may be bringing, we may have found sort of the kernel of the legal issues to bring a case against the state based on underfunding of legal counsel. And by the way, if you're interested in the legislative stuff, our review of the General Assembly session is just out this week, and it talks about that issue among other things. And you can get it on our website. What's that?
If you give us the information, we post it on our website.
Okay, good. I will. It's on our website, but I can send it to you.